Sea frets were usual at this time of year, but in the last few minutes the warm afternoon sunshine had been obliterated by a thick, swirling mist. Wallace peered hard through the windscreen as his car crawled towards the indistinct shape of the derelict buildings. He'd always found old wartime airfields to be deeply spiritual places where the ethereal wisps of human spirit lingered to await the oblivion of eternity. He shuddered involuntarily. At last, the familiar black shape of the hangar emerged massively from the murk. The old pilot stopped the car and got out. There was no obvious sign of anyone around. Perhaps he should come back tomorrow. No, he'd come a long way and would stay, for a little while at least. There would be crowds tomorrow, and he needed time alone to reflect. He'd looked forward to this trip so much, yet he'd dreaded making it, especially now. Didn't they realize the significance of tomorrow's date? Or was it all just an uncanny coincidence that only he would share? Oblivious to the skin-tingling chill, he hobbled wearily up the overgrown path to the old crew entrance. Surprisingly, the steel door was unlocked and screeched eerily on its rusty hinges as Wallace pulled it open.
"Hello?"
he called. There was no reply. Stepping inside, he squinted through the shadows to the gloom beyond.
"I'm Squadron Leader Wallace. Is anyone there?"
The metallic rebound of his own voice was the only response to his call. As his sight adjusted to the dim interior, the focus of his visit gradually crystallized towards the far end of the building. It was a late 1930s Fairey Battle Light Bomber, a monoplane aircraft designed to replace the biplanes of the day, but hopelessly inadequate against the enemy against which it was thrown in the opening stages of World War II. The old man's eyes glistened as a host of memories burst forth in a sudden wave of emotion and nostalgia. He approached the silent machine, unconsciously smoothing the empty left sleeve of his blazer. His squadron letter, B for Baker, had been painted on the restored fuselage. Quite right, too, he mused. After all, this was, in large part at least, the actual machine he had flown to Holland on that fateful day. Sadly, they'd both returned permanently disabled and had been grounded ever since. The long canopy had been covered with white parachute silk ready for the unveiling ceremony tomorrow, but the belly hatch hung open. He approached and stooped awkwardly beneath the wing to emerge with his upper body inside the body of the aeroplane. Looking forward, the cockpit was hollow, bare, and smelled of paint, but the glow inside was uncanny. The sparse light had been filtered further by the translucent parachute material to produce a monochromatic scene with grey as the primary colour. The seat, from which he'd been dragged and gravely wounded 50 years ago, was now gleaming with its new coat of paint. There was no sign of the ragged holes in the fuselage caused by shrapnel which had claimed both his arm and the life of his observer, Sergeant Jackson. As he turned around to face where Jackson had been lying, he suddenly glimpsed a movement out of the corner of his eye. He started violently, his whole body jerking as a massive charge of adrenaline exploded through his veins. Facing him was the silhouette of a man, his head eclipsing the blurred outline of a hangar window. Wallace swallowed hard. No, it couldn't be. Could it? Jackson? He gasped in disbelief.
No, sir,
the voice echoed strangely in the confined metal space.
My name's Savage, Tom Savage, Sergeant, Royal Air Force.
Wallace exhaled loudly. The emotional tension building around tomorrow's event and the fatigue after his long drive were obviously combining to play tricks on his imagination. Savage moved. The light caught his fair hair and pale features. He looked about 20 years old. He was wearing heavy sheepskin flying boots and his light blue serge uniform, underneath which was a white polo-necked sweater. Wallace recognized the old combat rig immediately. It seemed that the staff here was getting into the spirit of tomorrow's ceremony already. Wallace's gaze settled on the youngster's face. There was a distant flicker of recognition. The name, too, was familiar, but he couldn't quite place either. He held out his hand. "Pleased to meet you, Sergeant. My name's..." But the other man interrupted.
"Pilot Officer Wallace, one of our squadron pilots. I know you, sir."
Wallace frowned. How very odd. He hadn't been called Pilot Officer Wallace since he'd lost his... well, not for a very long time. Savage obviously didn't see Wallace's outstretched hand. He seemed to be searching for something.
"Excuse me, please, sir, but I've misplaced my cigarette case, and I must find it before takeoff."
"Well, I hope you don't miss tomorrow's ceremony."
"From what I've heard, sir, there'll certainly be a big show. Let's hope it's not going to be a ceremony."
Wallace's puzzlement deepened. There seemed to be a parallel quality about their conversation. His eyes narrowed further.
"When did you lose your cigarette case?" "The skipper asked me to check over the aircraft. I must have dropped it then."
Wallace felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck. He was more confused than afraid.
"But, Sergeant, this is my aircraft, B. Baker. I'm here to do my own checks."
Wallace's roleplay was instinctive and spontaneous.
"Oh no, sir, you're mistaken. This is F for Freddy, Flight Sergeant Bill Price's aircraft."
Wallace recognized the name immediately. Another shot of adrenaline surged around his body. He gripped the edge of the hatch. It was time to stop the roleplay and get back to reality.
In a sense, you're right," his voice faltered. "But I think we're talking at cross purposes here."
His breath came in short gasps, and he found it difficult to speak above a whisper.
"Sergeant, this is a non-flying fairy battle which last saw combat 50 years ago tomorrow. It was painstakingly rebuilt from two crashed aeroplanes. The tailplane and rear fuselage where you are searching did indeed belong to F. Freddy, which crashed on takeoff. However, the front section, wings and engine were salvaged from B. Baker, my old aeroplane. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the last raid in which these two aircrafts took part, and I will be dedicating this magnificently reconstructed machine to the memory of all the fairy battle aircrew that died as part of the Advanced Air Striking Force in Europe in 1940.
"Sorry, sir," Savage interrupted. "Did you say that F. Freddy had crashed?"
He looked puzzled.
"F. Freddy crashed on takeoff for a raid over Holland on the 14th of May, 1940. The pilot, Flight Sergeant Price, was killed. The observer's body was never found."
Wallace's voice tailed off as an incredible notion began to form in his mind. By now, Savage had become very agitated.
"But that's impossible,"
he stammered.
"The 14th is tomorrow."
He paused for a moment.
"Will you show me where F. Freddy crashed, please, sir?"
Still confused and dazed, Wallace nodded vacantly and led the way to his car. The mist had thickened, but he remembered every inch of the airfield. They drove without speaking to the threshold of the now disused runway.
"We took off from the far end."
Wallace's eyes gazed as he recalled the events of that last raid. He didn't look at his passenger.
"F. Freddy was number 5 in the takeoff sequence. I was number 6. Shortly after we'd all got airborne, F. Freddy sank rapidly and crashed over there."
Wallace's crooked finger trembled as he pointed. Savage got out of the car and set off in the direction indicated by Wallace. After a few paces, his shape softened in the swirling mist. Then, without a sound, an intense orange glow appeared deep inside the fog. Wallace watched, awestruck, as the striding figure was caught in silhouette. A moment later, the glow disappeared, and Savage was gone. Within minutes, the fog lifted, and the afternoon sun again bathed the airfield in its warmth. There was no sign of Savage, aircraft wreckage, or anything untoward. Perplexed and bewildered, Wallace drove on to his hotel. The dedication ceremony took place the following day as planned. Wallace, the principal speaker, paid tribute to the valor of the highly vulnerable battle aircrew and unveiled the aircraft as a memorial to their courage. Throughout the afternoon, he circulated amongst the crowd of veterans and relatives until only a handful remained. Now, at last, he had the opportunity to sit in the seat he had occupied exactly 50 years before. Unaided, he climbed into the cockpit and lowered himself down into the seat. As the crazed and yellowed Perspex canopy closed over him, the light level dropped, and the ethereal glow of the previous day returned. It was remarkably quiet. He scanned the lifeless instruments. The controls were limp to the touch. Sadly, he reflected, this was no longer a warplane. It was a corpse, a mummified shell whose soul had leaked away through the years of neglect and subsequent restoration. His eyes came to rest on the master switch. Idly, he flipped it to the on position. Immediately, the cockpit lights came on, and a gyroscope could be heard winding up. I'm impressed, he murmured, looking outside, wondering if anyone had noticed his tamperings. Strangely, there was no one around. He tried to turn the switch off again, but it wouldn't move. Open-mouthed, he gaped into the cockpit. As if moved by an unseen hand, the engine priming pump moved in and out. The throttle advanced to the start position, and the magneto switches tripped to live. Instinctively, he tapped the dormant fuel gauges. The needles quivered across the face of the dials to show full on both sides. Oh, no! Frantically, he tried to open the canopy. It was jammed. His efforts to reverse the engine start process were in vain. Horrified, he looked outside for help. Suddenly, his attention was distracted by the flickering light in front of him. The propeller was turning. No! That simply wasn't possible. The engine was a rusty wreck. Besides, there was utterly no sound, save for his own, now distressed, breathing. He gasped. The main hangar doors opened in front of him, and the battle moved forwards into a veil of fog similar to that of yesterday. A moment later, the fog cleared, and there, lined up in silence on the runway in front of him, were 3, 4, 5 other battles, the sun glinting through their rotating propellers.
Damn this weather!
The word suddenly broke the silence and crackled electronically in his head.
Jerry'll cut us to pieces!
Startled, Wallace put a hand to his ear. Inexplicably, he was wearing headphones. Jackson? His voice was incredulous.
No, sir. Tom Savage.
Wallace looked around to see the pale, boyish face of the man he had met the day before. What's going on, Savage?
I now know it was my fault that F. Freddy crashed. But the skipper and I weren't destined to die on the end of a runway. Even though it's certain we would have been killed on the raid, we had a job to do. With your help, 50 years on, I'm going to do that job for both of us. Take me to Holland, sir, please.
But we can't... A signal lamp flickered from an old control tower.
There's the green light, sir.
Savage pointed.
We're cleared for takeoff.
One by one, the first four battles took off. Wallace looked to his right. F. Freddy's engine wound up to its silent crescendo. The pilot, now recognizable as Bill Price, looked across at Wallace, gave a wave, and trundled forwards. There was no sign of an observer in the rear.
Now it's our turn, sir. We must go. Please.
Wallace looked down to his left. A strong, young hand reached for the throttle. Oh, how sweet its long-forgotten touch. The hand suddenly thrust forwards, and the roar of the engine abruptly exploded into the cockpit. Man and machine became merged once more as the aircraft trembled in anticipation, and together they lurched into F. Freddy's slipstream. As they clawed for height, F. Freddy suddenly dropped out of sight. The horrific orange flash was just as Wallace had remembered. Mercifully, B. Baker was immediately enveloped in cloud. Moments later, the five remaining battles emerged from the cloud in loose formation at low altitude. The target, a vital bridge over the Albert Canal, was clearly visible in the distance. Then the enemy guns began weaving an impenetrable web of death and destruction ahead of the obsolete and lumbering aeroplanes. The leader went first in a crimson bloom, followed seconds later by his wingman.
Bomb doors open!
Wallace felt the cold touch of fear dab at his brow. It wasn't death he was afraid of, it was something else. He could sense some other dreadful event was only moments away. A fiery blush of expanding debris smeared the sky ahead with the remains of the next brave crew, whilst to the right, an inferno on the ground marked the site of a fourth war grave. Only Wallace's battle remained airborne. It soon became the center of all hostile attention, receiving many hits from small arms fire. He dived B. Baker until it almost touched the ground.
"Bomb's gone!"
cried Savage triumphantly. Almost immediately, the target disintegrated in an eruption of masonry and flame. Seconds later, there was another detonation, this time much closer. Wallace had relived this terrifying ordeal countless times over the last 50 years, but its impact now was no less harrowing. A large, jagged hole appeared in the fuselage down by the throttle quadrant. His left arm felt numb and useless, but there was no pain.
"Savage! Help me, Savage!" he slurred.
There was no reply. Vision blurring, Wallace instinctively dragged the weary battle into a climb and was consumed in a blessed veil of cloud. He was fighting hard to control his severely damaged aeroplane, but above all, he must stay conscious.
"Squadron Leader Wallace, you all right?"
Wallace flicked his eyes wide open. The pain was intense. "Can you shut down the engine for me? My left arm has gone."
"Let me help you out of there, sir."
Wallace blinked. The late afternoon sun streamed through the hangar windows, and there was the general clatter of chairs being stacked.
"If one of the boys hadn't spotted you, sir, you could have been locked in for the night. Fancy a cup of tea?"
Wallace nodded vacantly. He looked down at his arm. The sleeve of his blazer was still neatly pinned to his pocket. The pain vanished. Dazed but relieved, he clambered out of the aircraft. It had obviously all been a vivid dream. As they entered the crew room, one of the occupants grasped his newspaper excitedly.
"Ah, sir, you'll be interested in this. The remains of British Airman Sergeant Thomas Savage have been found in Holland. He was declared missing during a raid by ferry battles on the Albert Canal bridges exactly 50 years ago. Now, there's a coincidence. Did you know him, sir?"
Wallace's jaw dropped in disbelief, but before he could reply, another man spoke.
"Did you say Savage? That was the name of the observer in F. Freddy. How on earth?"
He scratched his chin.
"Ah, well, I suppose that explains why his body was never found here. However,"
he reached into a drawer and held out a twisted slab of metal,
"this was."
With trembling hands, Wallace took the item and held it to the light. The name Sergeant Thomas Savage, RAF, was engraved on it. The man continued,
"That cigarette case was found jammed in the controls of F. Freddy. It undoubtedly caused the aircraft to crash on takeoff."
Wallace sipped his tea thoughtfully. What was it Savage had said just before takeoff? Something like, "I now know it was my fault that F. Freddy crashed." He must have known all along that by dropping the cigarette case in his aeroplane, he'd killed his pilot and friend. At that moment, another man burst into the crew room.
"The paint's peeling off both the pilot's seat and the observer's station. Underneath, well, it looks like blood."
The crew room emptied quickly, and Wallace was left alone to contemplate recent events. He was no longer distressed. The meaning of the last 24 hours was now clear. 50 years ago, Tom Savage had made a mistake for which he had paid the highest price. Now his spirit could rest in peace. As for the ferry battle, the men here had done a good job in restoring its shape, but it was he, Pilot Officer Wallace, who had restored its soul.